You're listening to Lost in Sound, a podcast exploring music, identity, and the future. I've always believed that one of the best ways we come together is through music. And through this series, I'm looking at how music can and is bringing us together now and in the future. From my base in Berlin, we'll be meeting artists from a range of disciplines from all across the world who are drawing on music right now, some already exploring new ways of doing this. Today, it's Mark Reeder. Hey, how's it going? I hope you're having a really good one. I'm actually not by the canal this week. I'm in Mainhainerplatz, still in Kreuzberg, in West Berlin, in Germany, in Central Europe. A couple of hours ago, went to get a weekly test. For English, British listeners, I'm not sure how... I'm sure you all know, but we're a lot more behind here with the vaccine rate, not wanting to get into the politics or anything about that. So I think that my sort of thing I do is to get a weekly test. I get it on a Sunday morning. I queue up outside a really amazing big building. And this morning I was looking at it and I had this kind of strangest feeling that the last time on a Sunday morning I queued up outside a building behind a big line of people was to go dancing, to go into a club and go dancing. And now it's to get a weekly test. This week's episode is kind of a redux. My guest, the legendary Mark Reeder. This interview appeared originally in a very, very, very edited format in one of the very first episodes when this podcast was called Lost and Sound in Berlin. And the idea was to always go back and show the full interview because it's such a fascinating talk. And I felt so honored for Mark to spend well over an hour chatting with me. So what you're about to hear is a chat that happened almost coming up for 3 years ago. And Mark is such, he's far too self-deprecating to call himself a legend. Who would? But he is kind of a Berlin legend, I think. He's been here from Manchester originally. He's been in Berlin since the late 70s, early 80s, and has always played a key cultural and creative role in the city from all of the eras. And so we sat down in a cafe only not that far away from where we are now, a cafe called Kukuma. And the interview was done on May the 1st, which is a special day in Berlin as well. It's a day of kind of anarchy and celebration. Of course, that's not going to really happen this year, although I've heard that some stuff is going on. I felt super honored to hear this story. It's a story Mark tells that goes into the heart of a very, very different time from what we have now. Musician, record producer, label owner, the star of the Berlin documentary B-Movie, Mark Reeder has somehow been somewhere just ahead of where the action is for over 40 years now. One of the first Brits in Berlin, even before then, in Manchester, he was in the band Frantic Elevators with a certain Mick Hucknall. He was Factory Records' German rep owner of the labels MFS and Flesh. He was there in the heart of 80s new wave Berlin alongside Nick Cave and Gudrun Gutt amongst people. And he was there as a nurturing force as techno was born. He discovered Paul Van Dyk as well. He's just released Subversive Decadence, a double album which features his own tracks and remixes for the likes of New Order, Yellow and Liars. And this is a story he shared one day in a cafe in Kreuzberg.
Hello, my name is Mark Rieder and we are in Berlin Kreuzberg 61.
61, yeah. Yesterday, it's 36, isn't it? The one where all the May Day stuff happens.
Yeah, that's the other part of Kreuzberg, yeah. Because Kreuzberg split into two parts.
Yeah.
Actually, the 3661 is just a postal code. It's just the designation of what it used to be, because Berlin used to have 1,000 as the postcode, and then Berlin 61 or 36 or 42 or 30, they designated which parts of town you were in.
Yeah. So was this the area that you first came to?
No, actually, it wasn't. When I first arrived here, I was in Schöneberg, near Nollendorfplatz in Winterfeldstrasse. Yeah, which is, back then, it was all, you know, Schöneberg was very studenty back then.
Yeah.
Now it's all residential. But nearly all the people who used to live, actually, in the 70s and early 80s in Schöneberg, nearly all of them still live there, you know. And in the meantime, they stopped being students and become kind of businessmen or whatever.
Yeah. I've noticed that when we're interviewing some people in Prenzlauer Berg as well, that, like, you know, they kind of moved their squatting and now they're the kind of the gentry there.
I think that happens quite a bit, actually. You know, if you fight for a house, you don't want to give it up so easy.
That's true, actually. Yeah. So there's more value to things.
Well, it's if you've put a lot of work into, like, maintaining it and stopping it from being torn down or whatever, or being turned into, like, luxury apartments or whatever, you know, you tend to want to kind of hang on to that. I mean, you know, the house that I initially lived in, that was due to be torn down. When I first arrived here, I just hitchhiked to Berlin.
Yeah.
And the guy who was driving me said, "Where are you staying tonight?" And I said, "I have no idea." And he went, "You can stay in our house. It's about to be torn down, so, you know, you can stay for as long as you like until it gets torn down." So I stayed there for about 8 months. Mm. And they gave us a skeleton key.
Mm.
So I could get for a flat upstairs, right? The whole house was empty, apart from these students who lived on the second floor. And they were just waiting for an alternative apartment to move into. The people who ran that house were going to give them a new place, but it had to be big enough for, like, sort of like 8 people, whatever. And so they were just hanging around there waiting. And so they said, "Hey, you can just, like, live upstairs, no one cares." You know, the whole house had electricity and gas and everything. Yeah, it was like, you know, like in England, they turn everything off.
Yeah,
they didn't give a shit. Yeah. You know? So it was, like, all there, and I had this, like, amazing 6-room apartment with a marble bathroom and, you know, like, parquet floorboards and stuff and balcony, and it was quite incredible, and it was free, you know, for the first 8 months. And then when the wrecking crew came, you know, the people were moving out, and I moved into one of the guy's brother's flats, which was on the Monumentenbrücke. I lived there for like a month, and then I got my own flat here in Kreuzberg, just literally around the corner here.
Yeah.
In Nostitzstrasse. That's where and it was a tiny little flat, like, you know, like 25 square metres or something. That was completely. But it was perfect for me at the time because, I didn't have much. I didn't bring much with me. So it was perfectly all right. The problem became a problem when I started to bring this stuff back from the UK, you know, like records and things like that.
Yeah.
And then I had no place to live virtually. It was like the room was just full of records.
I think that's what, you know, like, I mean, in the movie as well, like, you sort of talk about sort of like turning up to the guy from Tangerine Dream's house. Was it like records that led you here partly as well?
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, I only came here to buy some records. You know, my idea about traveling around Germany was just purely to buy records, you know, initially.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to see it, of course, but I just thought, oh, you know, like in Germany, I could probably get some of these like German imports, German records that you can't get as imports in the UK.
Yeah.
And I hadn't kind of like planned on staying or anything. And I just kind of, you know, for my first trip to Germany was in 1976. And I went to West Germany, Cologne, Hamburg. And I thought, I'll have a look at a few other places. Like I went to Munich and, you know, have a look around there. And I thought, oh, you know, Berlin was so far away back then. You know?
Yeah, it was on the edge. People always talk about it at that time being like on the edge of the Western world.
Well, it was like beyond the Western world. You know? It was in the middle of East Germany. You know, it was. You had to go through this transit route. Flying was never an option because it cost like £650 to fly to Berlin. You know, with British Airways. So, you know, people just didn't do it. You know, it was just so far away. And I'd say to people in West Germany, oh, I'm thinking about going to Berlin. And they were always very negative about, you know, like, no one encouraged me. Oh, yeah, you have to go see it. You know, it was like, what do you want to go there for? So I was like quite intrigued. I thought, if nobody comes here, then maybe there's loads of record shops crammed with all these old records that no one buys. So I came. And I never left.
Amazing.
You know, I just came to buy some records and never left.
That sounds like something someone would have on a t-shirt or something. Like, I came to Berlin to buy some lousy records and all I got was this t-shirt or something like that.
And I never left.
Yeah. So, like, you know, you mentioned about Cologne and stuff like that. Did you go and visit, like the kind of, what's it called, the Inner Space Studios?
No, but then people didn't do things like that.
Right, yeah, yeah.
They didn't do things like that. It wasn't like you make that effort and go and, you know, and obviously I went to Dusseldorf and was thinking, oh, you know, maybe you'd meet Kafka on the street.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it didn't happen. But when I got here, because I'd been working for Virgin in Manchester, right? When I got here, I had a Gefreuse's address. I don't know if I had a Gefreuse's address. I've no idea how I got this address. And I realised he just lived quite close, you know, so after a couple of months, I think it was, or a couple of weeks, maybe 6 weeks or something, I decided, right, now I'll go and have a look, see if I can say hello. Went around to his house, rang the doorbell, and his wife answered the door, and the kid was kind of hanging on the leg. Yeah. And she was, yes, and I was like, is Edgar here? She's like, who are you? You know, I'm from Manchester. She's not here. He's on tour in England.
No, classic.
So I never did that again.
Did you run into him at a later time?
I did, yes, of course. Yeah, later on. I had a good laugh over that one. But it was an interesting character, actually. I really liked him.
A lot of the stuff, so apologise if I'm over-covering stuff that's already in B-movie and you've probably spoken about a million and 500 times.
Well, not everyone's seen
B-movie. That's true, actually, yeah.
Because it's not available in the cinemas. It's not done a cinema release. So, you know, if you've not seen it, you don't know about it, and you can cover it, you know.
That's true, actually. I mean, but it is amazing. It's definitely sort of, in a way, someone was telling me the other day that it kind of reminded them of what happened with Nail and I, in that it's just one of those films that came out and now slowly filtering around, people are talking about, and it seems like everyone's trying to get hold of it or see it somehow or anything like that. How did were you approached about this initially?
No. I was approached to restore the sound, to be honest. The producer who... Funnily enough, it was the guy. The film's produced by three people. One of them was actually one of my next door neighbours. I didn't know this at the time, you know, that he was like working on this film, working with this guy. But they were working on this idea of having a collage of images to set to music of the time. And they asked me if I would be interested in restoring the music so that it sound good in a cinema. And as we're doing this, talking about what we're going to do, I thought, you know, when he was explaining that this imagery and everything, this kind of jigsaw collage, whatever, I was like, I've got quite a few things at home that maybe be, you know, shows Berlin in the 80s. I thought, I never thought about myself, you know, I just thought, like, I've got like a footage, maybe I can make a bit of money out of selling them a bit of footage, 2 minutes, you know. And I just gave him a box of tapes and said, yeah, look through those. If you might find some interesting images, let me know. And they were like, what's this? What's all this footage? What's all this stuff? You know, it's like, it's crazy. And then as they started to like talk about my me being here in the 70s and coming here in the 70s and what I experienced throughout the 80s, they've thought, well, maybe this is a better perspective, you know, like from some the point of view of a foreigner, you know, a non-German. My opinion of like what Berlin represented and what it meant to me and how I'd been involved in this kind of like Berlin music scene and everything at the same time, you know, so it just kind of unraveled itself, you know, and that was it then. It was like, then they realised, like, you know, like I've got quite a cynical approach, and so it was if it had been a German telling the story of Berlin, West Berlin, it would have been a really sad tale, you know, about division and politics and stuff, you know, because, you know, let's face it, you know, Berlin was never really, prior to the 80s, really, it wasn't seen as a musical city. You know, Berlin was always seen as a political place. You know, this was the place where the Third World War would definitely happen, and, you know, East meets West and all this rubbish, you know. And so you know, when Bowie came to Berlin, he obviously put Berlin on the musical map.
Yeah.
But still, people were, it was like, you know, he made Heroes and then left, you know, and then there was a gap. There was kind of nothing for a couple of years, you know, until the dawn of the 80s, really, you know. And so it's like, I just happened to come at the right moment, I suppose.
So was it kind of surprising to you to kind of arrive here and then discover that there was this kind of sort of vibrant alternative scene?
Well, there wasn't.
There wasn't at the time.
No.
So that kind of happened after you'd got here.
Yeah, it happened while, you know, like in those 2 years of like 78, 79.
Yeah.
It started then, really. I mean, yeah, there was a bit of an interest in the kind of punk rock thing as well. You know, like Buzzcocks had played here and Sex Pistols were supposed to play here and they didn't. But there was a certain amount of interest, you know, but it wasn't like it was like thriving like in the UK, you know, since 76, it had kind of like infused everybody in the UK, whereas in Germany it was a bit sort of looked upon as being something suspicious. And also it was only here,
yeah.
You know, travelling around the rest of Germany, Dusseldorf, yeah, maybe, you know, but Munich, definitely not. It was all free jazz and kind of like, you know, Dixieland and all that, you know.
So, yeah.
And then it was hippie music.
Yeah.
You know. You know, Steve Hillage was massive, for example. They never even heard of the Sex Pistols. You know, it was that Joy Division didn't enter into it. You know.
Yeah.
It was like a big gap between, you know, compared to the UK. So when I got here, it was just starting to emerge, really. You know, they had one punk rock band with one single, you know, Sie verlassen den amerikanischen Sektor by Tempo. That was the only punk rock single that I saw here at that time.
Yeah.
And then there's another band called PVC. And it just started, and you know, like the Zenzo record label, which is kind of Anglophile record shop in the back of a clothing shop in Schöneberg. That was like the place where people, if they were into that kind of music or they'd read the NME or whatever, they could go and buy records. But otherwise, you had no other places to buy stuff like, you know, new music from the UK. Because it wasn't happening at that point here.
That's true. I mean, I guess, like, you know, there was a massive whole kind of border and a whole, you know, kind of east-west thing, kind of stopping things getting over here as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, distribution was only done by the major record labels, you know. So, you know, stuff that was coming out on major record labels in the UK or whatever might find their way into German record shops, you know, in Berlin or whatever. But the thing that had mattered to me at that point, you know, this kind of new wave thing, that didn't really find its way into the shops here until really the beginning of the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And how did you get involved with being Factory's representative?
Oh, well, I'd known Ian before even he was in Joy Division. And I knew Rob before he'd even, when he was a DJ, really, because working in a record shop, you know, you meet all these kind of people. And Rob, you know, we'd always buy, and actually Tony Wilson, for that matter, he'd always come in and on Saturday nights, you know, like just before we closed, and hang around.
that was his perfect time.
Well, he didn't want to be, because he was a TV personality.
Right, I see.
He read the news on the TV, and he didn't want people to constantly bother him. So he'd come quite literally like 10, 15 minutes before we closed on Saturdays. And then he knew he could then stay in the shop and just listen to records in private, basically.
Yeah.
And he'd always say, save all the best ones till the end. You know, and so he could go through everything. And that's how I got to know these people. And when I left Manchester, Rob was like, "Oh, you know, we're going to re-release An Ideal for Living as a 12-inch. You know, can you maybe give a few to radio stations in Berlin or something like this? You know, because these Brit soldiers here. You know,
so
the idea was, you know, to sell a few in Germany and maybe get it played on the radio." Nah, forget it. It didn't work. You know, I sent all these records out. Rob sent me a big box of records, and I sent them to all these the magazines of the day that was available in Germany. Like trash, really. I mean, it's like that. No chance. Now, of course, I believed in this record wholeheartedly. This was the best band in the entire universe, and it was like there was no other band that, even in Manchester, like Joy Division. You know, and it was like there was. I thought, people have to understand it, you know, they'll love it when they hear it, and they'll love it when they... Nah, I didn't... No one was interested, not in the slightest.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, like, a lot of the music that sort of came up in the 80s from Berlin kind of comes from a similar sort of place in the heart as Joy Division.
Totally, yeah. You know. And also a lot of it back then was considered unlistenable.
Yeah.
You know, like, what's this rubbish, you know? Even... You know, when Tony Wilson and Rob decided that I should do Factory Germany and pay for it myself, I was like, no way.
Classic.
You know, it's like that. The idea is like, what would you want to release on the record label? You know, and I'm giving him things like Mania D and Malaria, you know, early Malaria ideas and things like this. And they're like, it's fucking rubbish, that. How am I supposed to sell that? They can't play the instruments, they can't sing. It's like the songs are crap, you know, like, devastation. So you've got to see them live, it's really interesting. Nah, they you know, Tony Wilson was really kind of like focused on the USA.
Yeah.
On selling stuff to the Americans and making his artists big in the States.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Yeah. That was the main focus. So obviously it wasn't like, you know, like Mania D, you know, for them it was just like unsellable.
So all of these things didn't get a legendary FAC number.
They didn't, no. Well, because I was friends with Anique Honoré, who ran Factory Benelux and Ludistic Upper Schools with Michel Duval, I was able to convince Anique to release Malaria on Ludistic Upper School.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, let's do a single at least, you know. So we did one single, and it got a really good reaction.
Yeah.
You know, and I liked Rob's, like, see, you know, it does work. But when New Order played in Brussels for the first time, we got Malaria to support them on that gig, and everybody really enjoyed it and thought they were really good. Still didn't release the record, like, you know. But then they understood them, and they all got on really well with everybody. So it got, you know, their image was changed basically through that association, I suppose, and Bernard and Gudrun got on really well together, you know, and I thought, oh, maybe we could get a release in the UK on Factory, but it never happened. It only became the Factory Benelux, well, actually, the District Cup of School release. You know,
do you think it's sort of like in the long term that's kind of really paid off that these things didn't quite happen, because it's maybe, sort of
that's part
of the identity of Berlin is about not being pushing the kind of American dream of big sales.
Yeah, well, that's just how it is, isn't it? It's the fate, really. You know? It's, you know, just how it's gone, you know. Maybe their careers would have been different if we'd have released it on a factory a label or something, but we'll never know. You know, it's just how it went. You know, and I don't think they did too bad out of not having a release on Factory. You know, I released my record on Factory. Didn't do anything for me. You know, it's like, it wasn't like suddenly I was like a massive overnight. You know, it didn't have any effect on my career whatsoever. In fact,
do you remember what offhand what the Factory number of it was?
My record, Factory 111.
Well, that's a great number, isn't it, for it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard other people talk about how they'd go out so much in the 80s because the coal heating would take so long to heat flats up.
No, that's lies. They lie to you.
Really?
It's not because the coal heating. No, it's not because the coal heating didn't heat the flats up warm enough. It was because they couldn't get up in time to go to the coal merchant to buy the coal to heat the flats. That's the reality. Right? That's the reality. They went out all night.
Yeah.
And slept all day.
Damn.
And then you'd get up at like 10 to 6 and you'd realise, crap, I've missed the coal merchant. He's going to be shut in 2 minutes, you know.
So back out again.
So you'd have to go out again, find a club. Or, you know, there were quite a few cinemas here, like the Arsenal cinema in the Fuggerstrasse, which was always a real haunt for, you know, it's all these like Tarkovsky films and all the kind of weird avant-garde stuff in it. And it'd start really early, like 7:30. So you'd spend like a couple of hours in the cinema. Nice and warm, watching movies, and then, you know, you'd move on to a cafe or something, and you'd hang around there for a while, and a bar, and then a club, and then it was time to go home.
Amazing. And then in B movie, there's a scene where you're outside this club at 7 a.m, and it's really amazing.
Risiko.
Right, yeah. Risiko, what's there now? Yeah.
It's travel agent.
Travel agent, right, yeah. That's really crazy as well, isn't it? Because I kind of sometimes wonder why there still are travel agents. I guess some people don't go online. But
yeah, some people.
It's interesting, yeah. Do you have like a fondness for, you know, how do you look back on these times?
Well, I'm not nostalgic, you know. I'm not like, you know, it's part of my life and part of my history, I suppose.
But yeah.
I don't dwell on it and think, oh, I wish, you know. It was always like that. There are things I miss, you know, and feelings that I miss, you know, the thrill of like going into East Berlin and smuggling stuff into the East Berlin.
Yeah.
You know, that was really super unnerving, but also at the same time totally thrilling, especially when you've done it and you managed to get through and everything and didn't catch you, you know. And it was like this feeling of utter elation, you know. I miss that, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that process?
About
going through to East Berlin. Yeah.
Well, it was like, you know, it was a very it was like the hardest club to get in. It was worse than getting into Berghain.
Yeah,
like, if you think Berghain's bad, you should have tried getting into East Berlin. You know, it was, you know, you had your passport control, who then look at your passport, look at everything, and then you go to the customs control and then look through all your pockets and make sure you take how much money you were taking in, and you have to write it down on a piece of paper, like this kind of like this thing they gave you that you had to write, the declaration which you had to write in. What are you taking into East Berlin with you? You're taking a camera, yeah? You're taking a... how much money, how much Western currency you're taking in. And that had to tally when you came out. So you couldn't go in with 20 mat West marks and come out with 10. Because they'd say, where did that other 10 go?
Oh my gosh, everything is just totally accountable for
So you know, like, you could take cine camera in. It was really, really difficult. You could take a photo, like a normal like a camera in.
Yeah,
take still photos. You could do that, but like taking a cine camera in was like, that was a no go. Or you couldn't take a cassette player in, you know, like a Walkman or something like that. You couldn't even take that in.
So I guess you can record on it.
You know, that was really, it was really, really hard.
Yeah.
They were really strict, you know, as to what you were allowed to bring in. And everything was monitored. I mean, you know, like, I mean, you were registered the minute you walked through the gate, you know. And for Brits, you know, as we were part of the Fourth Power Pact of Berlin, it meant that we could go over Checkpoint Charlie or Friedrichstrasse Underground Station, railway station. We could go into East Berlin that way or go via Checkpoint Charlie. Checkpoint Charlie looked like a big petrol station.
Yeah.
Like a petrol pump. A bit unnerving because it's a walk, you know. Whereas when you got to Friedrichstrasse, when you actually got off on the train, you were actually in East Berlin already.
Yeah,
and you just had to go through the passport controls. But it was, you know, I'd smuggled cassettes into East because they were the easiest, you know. A very, very first time I met some people in Prague in 78 and I smuggled some records in for them, like singles and stuff. But it was really hard, you know, like a single, a record or a vinyl or something is not an easy thing to smuggle, in, especially in the summertime.
So no, well, it, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's like, you know, where you put thing, it, you know, it? Yeah. Where you're going to put it, you know.
You can't stick it up, you know, you can't do the prison.
So. You can't do that. No. So cassettes were really a lot easier.
Mm.
Yeah. You had to prepare the cassette, you know, so it doesn't rattle and stuff like that and take it out of its box and stuff. But it was an easier item to smuggle into East Berlin, so I smuggled cassettes in. And when I got into like this, I met these kids in East Berlin by pure chance. I met this kid on the underground, and I was thinking, you know, there must be something happening here. I went to gigs in East Berlin, you know, had a look and see what was happening there. And these were all kind of officially kind of, the bands were state regulated, you know, they'd been approved by the
right,
by
it's the, more sort the of state, Schlager
you know.
Kind
no,
of.
No, it wasn't. It was like rock music, but it was like, you know, this, it was drivelly kind of like 70s rock, you know, it was like tepid versions of Free or something like this, right? They were all that kind of like dressed in jeans and playing blues and, you know, like progressive rock stuff. And it was like, there must be something else. There's nothing else. You know, and it was like trying to find stuff. And I saw this kid on the train. He was wearing a pair of drain pipes and it was a bit spiky hair. And I thought, oh, he knows where there's some, maybe some kind of new wavy kind of bands playing of some kind, you know. And I ran up to him and I asked him, like, he got off the train and I ran after him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I said, do you know anywhere? And he's like, there's nothing like, there's no punk rock. It's all forbidden. I'm like, well, the way you look, he's like, I can't, you know, this is about as far as I can go. He said, everything is forbidden here. You know, there are no punk rock concerts, nothing. Like, what about records? Nothing. You know, they listen to it off the radio.
Yeah.
And that's it. So I gave him my address. I wrote him my address and said, if you hear, is anything happening, write me a postcard, let me know. They couldn't telephone into the West by this point, and I didn't hear anything from him at all.
Yeah.
And then a couple of months later, I get a letter from this girl asking to meet me at the Palast der Republik, which was the former parliament building, in the cocktail bar upstairs.
Right? Yeah.
They had this beautiful round cocktail bar. It looked like a set from Stanley Kubrick 2001. It was like,
I can kind of picture it, definitely.
It's
yeah. Yeah.
If you look on the internet, there's a few photographs of this like round bar. It's really beautiful. And she said, yeah, I'd like to meet you. Can you come over on these 2 days, one of these 2 days, and I'll be there and wait for you. Like, you know, go there, meet this girl, you know. And the thing is, not like today where you got Facebook, you can look at pictures to see what they look like and stuff like that. It was like could this be her? Or could she just be some girl, random girl? You know, anyway, I met her and she just kind of basically sounded me out, you know, like where am I from, what am I doing, what do I want? And she was involved in this kind of little kind of new wavy punk rock scene of kids who in East Berlin was kind of like, they were having parties at home. Really, because there was nowhere for them to go, so I fell in with these kids, you know, and eventually I ended up like, you know, having this idea of, and I met some hippie. I was with some other people in a bar in Berlin on these long trestle tables. On this hippie sit at the end, and he was actually listening into our conversation. And at one point, he just said to me, "You're not from here, right?" You know, because he could tell that I was, because my German was so bad. And I'm like from England, and he was like amazed, you know, like it's like someone from England to be in East Berlin and stuff. And we just got talking about music. He was obviously really into his music, this guy, but he liked things like, you know, Bob Dylan and stuff like this. And he told me that he had an electric guitar, and he didn't have a permission for this guitar, and he didn't have permission to play in front of an audience, but he played in a church, right, as a so-called blues mass. And I'm like, what's that? Blues mass. And he was like, trying to explain, yeah, you know, I play like, you know, Go Tell It on the Mountain and stuff. Bob Dylan songs, Eric Clapton and that kind of thing. And I was like, oh, it's kind of like a gospel church in America, maybe. Mm. Wasn't really, but it was like, that was the closest I could make, association I could make to this. And I thought, oh, give us the address, you know, I'll come and see you. And I thought, I'll go and ask the priest, maybe I can play with my band, you know.
Mm.
And he explained, well, it's not a gig. It's a church service, you know, with prayers and everything. I'm like, yeah, I'll do everything. Don't care, you know, I'm not religious. I don't care. So But the difficulty was because I played in a band that was we had drum machines and synthesizers and stuff. Nobody in East Berlin had a synthesizer.
Yeah, right. I could imagine.
Yeah, the big acts like Carhartt or something, they might have one, but like, you know, these kids in East Berlin, they certainly don't.
I mean, like, anywhere in the world, like, when they'd got, like, you have to either make them or like they cost thousands and thousands of pounds.
Well, in the 70s, they cost thousands and thousands of pounds in the UK. Nobody had a synthesizer in the UK. You could buy a cheap guitar with your dole money, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know, it was a month's wages or something, you know, you could buy a guitar, but synthesizers were astronomical, you know.
It was the sort of like the privilege of like your David Gilmours and all of those people, wasn't it? Really?
Well, yeah, you know, the very, very few bands, even the big name bands, had synthesizers because they're so expensive. Mm. German bands had synthesizers because they're all bloody rich, you know. It was like Germans were like rich, you know.
Yeah, all
these bands had synthesizers. It was like, that's why I was so much into German synthesizer music.
Because they
all had synths, you know. Like, it was like you couldn't. It was like King Crimson or something. They might have had some like a Mellotron or something.
But you
just didn't find that.
Totally. It's like the economic miracle that kind of really sort of helped like krautrock really kind of develop into like the sort of ambient textures.
Yeah, but you know, because they could afford
this
stuff, whereas in the UK we certainly couldn't. And in East Germany, they didn't. You know, it was a myth.
Yeah,
synthesizer was just like, you know, well, you know,
this spaceship.
They'd never seen one, let alone buy one. You know, and even guitars. You couldn't just go to a guitar shop and just buy yourself an electric guitar and form a band.
Mm.
He couldn't do that in East Berlin, or in East Germany for that matter.
Yeah.
Or in any, you know, in East Berlin, there weren't any guitar shops that sold electric instruments. You could buy an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
You could buy a piano.
Mm.
You could buy a violin. But you couldn't buy an electric guitar.
Where would they get their electric guitars from?
From Prague. Or Hungary, or Poland, if they were lucky. But when martial law was declared in Poland in the late 70s, then it was impossible to go to Poland to get stuff.
Mm.
You know, so it was just, then you were just, your choices were just either Hungary or Czechoslovakia, you know. That was it, you know. But getting in the guitar is one thing, bringing it back into East Berlin, East Germany, is another thing. You know, it's like, what are you doing with that, you know? Have you got, what are you going to do with that guitar? You know, you do have permission to actually own it. You had to apply for permission to actually possess it, you know. And then you had to apply for permission to play it. And then they've like, there's some group of old blokes, you know, these are guys who really have a historical background in music, you know, they're all like former heroes of the working class, you know, like miners and steel workers, and this, they'd assess your proficiency as to whether you could play your instrument properly, and, you know, whether you would get the coveted permission to actually own this guitar and play it in front of an audience, you know. So it was really hard to even start a band, you know. And if you did start, if you managed to get a guitar from, say, from a flea market or something like that, you know, and actually start a band, the minute you started a band, you're under the observation of the Stasi, you know.
Gosh.
If anyone found out that, that's what you were doing, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't such an easy thing just to be in a band or play in a band or have a guitar. So this guy telling me this thing, you know, I didn't realise at that particular moment just how precarious it was for him to actually be doing this until I actually, you know, started to do it myself. And then I realised, like, this is really a different world, you know.
Yeah.
There aren't that many bands, you know, and the few that there are, you know, they're silent. You know, you don't know, they're not like playing gigs every week, you know, and they're certainly not in the church. So I went to this priest and asked him, like, about playing this gig, and he was like, well, you know, it's not a gig, it's a church service. And in the end, you know, I thought, oh, flipping out, well, I can't do this, you know. I actually played a gig in Prague in 1982 as the first illegal gig ever in Czechoslovakia by a band. You know, they had Western artists perform on telly, you know, like Boney M and stuff like that, right? But like secret gigs by unknown bands were not done. And I'd met these dissidents in Prague by chance, and we did this gig, which was disguised as a wedding reception in this kind of farmhouse in the outskirts of nowhere, in the middle of Bohemia, you know. And Czechoslovakia's most wanted. It's like all these dissidents turned up, you know, plastic people with the universe and all these people. Jolly Joker. And they all kind of turns up, you know, Garage, all these bands. You know, all these people turn up at this event and we all get completely sloshed and do this party. And at that time, I wasn't so aware about how significant it was.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But it turns out, you know, that it was and that it was possible as well. So having had this experience of actually being performing in Czechoslovakia, which was even more draconian in a sense than in East Berlin.
Yeah.
You know, we could do the gig in a church, same thing. And, but no, it was almost impossible. No one had lent us a cassette player.
Yeah.
Because in East Germany, you know, it was like that was the thing that you could record Western radio from, and they were so expensive.
Yeah,
you know, they cost like 2,000 East German marks, you know, for a cassette player. You know, it was like super expensive. You know, when your average wages were about 600 East German marks a month, you know, and your rent was maybe, you know, 20 marks or something, and a cassette player cost like $2,000. You know,
that's insane, isn't it? Yeah,
Trabant cost 10,000.
Shit,
you know. Yeah. And the cassette player was like dead expensive. So it was like something which people didn't necessarily want to give up straight away.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was like, well, what happens if we get raided by the Stasi? You know, the police come, and then everything gets confiscated. So they weren't willing to let us, because we had all our drum tapes.
Mm.
I'd made all these tapes, drum machine tapes, because I couldn't take our instruments.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So you'd be literally like kind of all of the drums would just be on a tape, played off a tape recorder when you'd go there. Yeah.
The drums and sequences and stuff. Yeah. So synths would be on that, you know. And
yeah.
I was like, maybe that could do that. But no one was prepared to let us. And it was just finding the stuff, you know, it's like so difficult. And then in the end, I kind of gave that up until sort of like, I was on tour with the Totenhosen.
Yep.
Mm. I was their sound engineer. And I thought, because I'd taken all the Totenhosen cassettes into East Berlin, of course, because they're in German, and I knew that my friends would be really into that, you know. So they all knew the music. And then I spoke to the band and said, would you be interested in playing in East Berlin? They were like, how are you going to do that? You know, it's impossible, you know. So, well, it's not necessarily impossible, maybe we could do it. Would you do it? And they were like, if you can get arrange it, we'll do it, you know. So I arranged it and took Totenhosen into East Berlin, and that was like, you know, we didn't go in a big group, we just went in groups of three.
So it's a bit like kind of getting into Berghain again, like breaking up, you know, a big group of your friends. You sort of break into little groups of two or three to kind of get through.
That was basically the idea.
Yeah.
Well, thought if you go in a big group, they'll know what's, they'll become suspicious.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see who didn't get in, just in case. And so we just went, we staggered the amount, you know, how many people went into us at the same time. So no one had to acknowledge that they knew each other and things like this. And we managed to get everybody in and do this gig in the church in Rummelsburg.
What would the kind of repercussions of if you'd got caught or if things had gone wrong or if the Stasi kind of got wind of everything?
Well, I told my friend, you know, initially when we were planning this gig, I said to them, you know, like, we could do this, but if you get caught, your lives will change forever. If I get caught, I'll never come back. They won't let me back in. So the only thing that you're going to miss is me bringing cassettes in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's it, you know. Whereas for you, your lives will change forever, you know, because you'll be blacklisted and, you know, your lives will be miserable. And I don't know what the consequences of like doing such a thing as an illegal gig would be, but it had never been done before, so it's probably to be really harsh just to make an example of you all, you know. And I think maybe a little bit of the driving, and it wasn't guys that were doing this, it's like there were two girls, right? It's two girls,
yeah.
And I think the idea of the thrill of it was all part of the actual attraction, because I went into East Berlin every week, you know, and take it smuggling cassettes in and stuff. I had that thrill every time I went in, you know, this thrill of elation of like succeeding, this thrill of like actually going through this, you know, rigmarole of kind of this cat and mouse game of trying to like take all this stuff illegally into East Berlin, and hopefully the customers wouldn't strip search me and find it, you know. Whereas they didn't have that in their daily lives. They had it in a different way, you know, with the Stasi and knowing that anybody could potentially be an informer. They had that. But this thrill of actually doing something against the state, they didn't actually particularly have, apart from the fact that they were punks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So to take this, it was a bit like the cherry on top of the cake, in a sense, right? It was like here's your opportunity to do, to have that feeling of elation and thrill of actually arranging something, doing something completely anti-state and totally illegal. You know, do you want to do this? You know, and they were like, yes. It was like no discussion. It was like, yes, we want to do this. We don't care what happens. You know, they might even throw us out of East Germany. You know, all right, okay. You know, so we went along with it and did this gig, and the whole time we're thinking, you know, the Stasi could come at any moment, the police could come at any moment and just kick the door in and we'd be all arrested. And, you know, and the suspicion of, like, who within the circle of friends we had who potentially could be a Stasi informer as well, you know, like, you never knew, you know.
Yeah.
That's why we only invited 30 people, because we wanted to diminish the risk of how many people. And these are all kind of like so-called trusted friends, you know. And we said, no photographs. Well, you know, I took my camera, but we only took like two photographs. The priest took two photographs, and that was it. That was even before the gig. It wasn't during the gig. We said no concert, no gigs, no photographs during the concert. As it turned out, you know, when I got to see Stasi file, and other people got to see their Stasi files, who were part of that scene, we discovered that some people had taken photographs. You know, there were Stasi informers. In fact, one of the people who was one of our closest trusted friends was actually a Stasi informer.
Crazy. You but know. They just kind of let it go.
Well, they wanted to see the gig, you know.
Right, yeah. That's...
And they were never going to... And this was one thing I realised afterwards. I was like, you know, they didn't inform on any of the gigs or any of the activities before they happened because they wanted themselves to actually experience that. If they'd have told in advance, oh, they're going to do a gig and it's going to be there and then and that, then the police would have definitely been there, you know.
Yeah.
And that would have been it, game over, and they would never have seen it, you know. So by saying in their reports, it'd be something like, you know, I only found out about it a few hours before it actually happened, and I went and there was no time to make a report prior to the gig, you know. So that's the way they got around actually, like, having to report in advance.
Yeah.
And in 88, we repeated this event in another church in Pankow. There was a band called Division, right, who were the only band in East Berlin who were officially allowed to sing in English because the singer was studying English at the Humboldt University. Right? Now, English... That was the language of the enemy, you know.
Yeah.
A school kid learned Russian at school. He didn't learn English, you know. So for him to be studying English at the university, he had to be proficient in Russian first. Had to be able to speak perfect Russian.
Yeah.
Right. And then he was allowed to then do this faculty that be learn English. And because he was learning English, he was able to sing in English. This is the theory anyway. And he created this. They had this band called Division. I'd seen them play a gig as another. They had another name, Coma Kino, they were called.
How come they had two names?
No, that was the original incarnation of the band, yeah. But the band that was forced to break up, and by the authorities. I don't know for what reason that happened, but at some stage the band was forced to break up, and the singer, he then formed this new group called Division. All are kind of a bit kind of Joy Division-y, something. And then we did this gig in the children's play part of the church, right? The kindergarten bit, open air. And we again only invited 30 people. It was all super secret and everything. And in the meantime, I'd befriended an American soldier who had a car, which we used for smuggling. So we were able to take the guitars and the bass and stuff and a video camera into East Berlin with us. And we get to this churchyard, and the police are sat outside, and we're like, oh God. And there's like 600 people all expecting the Tilt Nolson. I was like, who couldn't keep the trap shut, you know?
Yeah.
You know, this is ridiculous. My American friend, soldier, I've been a soldier. He wasn't allowed to fraternise with any East Germans, you know. So he was having a real difficult time, like having brought all our stuff. He couldn't have done it by accident, you know. And if they call the military police, then he's going to be in real deep trouble. So he couldn't actually see the gig because he had to sit in his car. He was all petrified that he might get arrested. And he just didn't want to risk the chance of being caught, you know. He was dressed in a full military dress uniform. So it was pretty obvious he was a US soldier.
Yeah,
how
yeah.
did you turn up at this gig, you know?
It's not just party outfit.
Not exactly. So he had a bit of a problem, so he couldn't actually get to see the gig. But the, you know, this thing was immediately stopped before it started, basically. The priest said to me, like, the police said, Tilt Nolson can't play. I'm going to have to announce to the people that the Tilt Nolson are not allowed to play. And I'm like, he goes, yeah, shit, you know, well, you're going to have to do that, you know. That's what they want you to do, you know. There's no way around this. But just tell everybody that a band from Dresden's going to play in the place. And he's like, what band? A band. So it's like, and he's like, oh, right, okay. All right. So this is what we did. So a band from Dresden. Because we said, I said, like, you know, Stasi and the East German police don't know who the...
They don't read Enemy.
They don't know who the Tilt Nolson are. They don't know what they look like. So it could be the singing in German, could be a band. So we played like 3/4 of an hour, and then it was like, then it obviously within all these 600 people,
yeah,
there's quite a few Stasi informers, and all of them knew that at some stage they're going to have to say to the authorities, look, that's the Tilt Nolson.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because, you know, they couldn't just let it run, and then they'd be in trouble too, you know, like, why didn't you say anything? So we play, the Tilt Nolson played for like 3/4 of an hour, and then it was like stopped. But no, funnily enough, like, nobody got arrested. I mean, it was a lot of people, so the police, and there was only one, like two coppers in their car, right, you know, like, so what are they going to do, you know? And it kind of, there was no incidents of anything, there was no kind of, you know, like, what do you call it? I don't know the German word. nobody caused any trouble.
Right, yeah.
There were no smashing of windows or daubing of paint of any kind, you know, graffitis. It was like everyone was really kind of cool about it, you know. And so the police was, there's no reason to arrest these people. They've all done it now, and they've, you know, they're all happy now. So that went off kind of like, as we thought, quite well. Is that only afterwards where everybody that we knew, all their flats got raided by the police secretly, you know. Like my friend said, yeah, the Stasi were in our flat, you know. And the neighbours had seen the Stasi entering into our flat, and they'd taken photographs of everything and looked through all our records and looked through all the periodicals that we'd acquired.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, they all were under observation.
You know, gosh. And then this was in 1988. So this is, it's kind of quite crazy, because that's not long before the wall came down, isn't it? So it's like sort of everyone under observation then. It wasn't that long before that just stopped anyway.
Yeah, but we didn't know that. Yeah. It wasn't like there was an indication, oh, the wall's going to come down another year.
Yeah, we've got another 2 months and 10 days. And,
you know, it wasn't like that at all. It was like this idea that the wall might actually come down ever was never in anybody's minds. You know, it wasn't a thinkable thing. You know, it was there for the duration, and I certainly never thought it'd happen in my life. You know, and in 1989, it was like the Division were given a recording contract with the Amiga because their popularity after doing this gig with This gig was disguised as a benefit concert for starving remaining orphans, right, in the church. After they'd done this gig, the authorities thought, well, what are we going to do with this band? Because their popularity suddenly just was like huge, you know, like going from just being this kind of obscure East German new wave indie band, whatever, to suddenly being this kind of like the band that played with the Tilt Nolson, and their status kind of rocketed, you know. So every time they were allowed to play in like youth clubs and things like that.
Yeah.
But since doing this gig with the Total Knowles, and it was like they were doing festivals, and it was their status really grew, and the authorities were like, "We're going to have to do something about this. Either we ban them, or we'll give them a recording contract." And so they chose the latter because they thought if we ban them, then their mythical status will be even bigger, and we won't be able to control them. If we release the records, we'll at least be able to control their output, what they do. So they gave them a recording contract, and the band asked me if I would produce this record. So I was invited to East Berlin to produce their album. Right? And as I'm producing their album, that like in May, the Hungarians had taken down the border defences between Hungary and Austria, and all these like East Germans started to trickle out of East Germany, and then it started to become a flood. You know, by June, it was a big flood of people wanting to go on holiday to Hungary. You know, for some reason. And then it started to kind of like get really stiff, and the situation in East Berlin started to become really grim. I mean, like it had been grim before, but it was by sort of like 89, like September 89. So it was getting really the pressure within on the general public. You could feel that. You know, it was like it was getting worse, you know.
Well, what kind of, how would that kind of manifest? How would you see that?
It was just a general kind of apathetic kind of like the way people were, you know, like they knew someone who'd managed to get out of the country, you know, and they were now living in Austria, or they'd gone to Germany or whatever. And it was, you know, and all these people who'd been kind of trapped in the embassy in West German embassy in Prague, you know, all them had all been transported to the West, and there was just this like cutting feeling of the tension in the air, you know. And then they had their 40th anniversary parade, which, because I was making this, I was one of the only Westerners who was actually allowed into the country.
Yeah,
you know, and I actually got to see this.
What
you
was
know.
It like?
It was so tense.
Yeah.
It was so tense. It was like, normally these parades, I'd been before to, you know, a couple and stuff, and there'd always been thousands and thousands of patriotic East Germans, you know, like waving flags and sort of like on the streets, you know, tens of thousands of East Germans. And this one was, there was a couple of thousand. And there was so few that they had the TV cameras that were broadcasting this live on East German television. They had guys with like ropes kind of herding the crowds into position so that the TV cameras, when they scanned the street, it looked like there were like thousands of people. But in actual fact, there were only a couple of thousand people, you know. And the tension was huge, you know, like people were scared that there was going to be a Tiananmen Square style kind of like revolution shooting, people might get killed and stuff, so they stayed at home. So, you know, I felt quite privileged to actually have experienced that. And, you know, I thought, but it wasn't like you thought this was going to happen, anything was going to happen at that moment. It was only when I got, after the parade had finished, and I went to see the presentation of Soldier of the Year. Alexanderplatz, and all the soldiers who'd participated in the parade, they were all at Alexanderplatz, all kind of like standing to attention and that, and this young officer of the year who'd been, you know, given this accolade had to give a speech, and I was behind, you know, the podium, and I could hear everything, and this guy was, this soldier was handed this note, which was what, you know, his speech that he had to give. And he was shaking like a leaf, you know, and everyone in the audience was like, total silence. Everyone was like, the anticipation that he might say, come on, lads, let's rebel, you know, like this is it, revolution or whatever. The anticipation was that you could feel this anticipation, you know, in the crowd. And the officers gave him this note, and he was looking at the note and shaking, and they were going, come on, you can do it, you can read it, go on, do it, you know, and I could hear this. And I'm thinking, what was it? What have they given him? And he obviously didn't want to read this one. And he was looking at it, and then he did read it. And it was like the deflation of like the anticipation of this moment. He could have said, rebellion now, you know. They probably would have, something would have happened then. But he didn't. And everybody in the audience was like, oh, you know, this like thousands of people just comes all at the same time going, it's like, I mean, I had like goosebumps, you know. It was like, whoa. That was it. I thought, they're never going to do it now. You know, yeah,
that was the moment.
That was for me. I thought, yeah, that's it. They've lost that moment,
yeah,
of revolution, really. Revolution within a revolution. It's gone now. That's it. They've lost the opportunity right now. And I thought, that's he's like, we've got another 40 years of East Germany, you know. And literally, like a week later, Erich Honecker had been deposed. You know, that was it. You know, I'd seen Mikhail Gorbachev. He'd waved to me personally, you know, like when I went over into East Berlin the night before, the day before. I come over the Oberbahnbrücke. I went over that way because they weren't letting anyone into East Berlin. I went over the Oberbahnbrücke, crossing point, and I came out, and there was Mikhail Gorbachev's car came past, and I was the only civilian on the street, so I waved to him, and he waved back at me, and I was like, wow, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev just waved to me. I didn't expect this, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that the government would be overthrown within a week. You know, or rather, Honecker had been deposed within a week.
Mm.
And then all these kind of like weekly, Monday discussions started to take place and stuff. And I was like, okay, it's good. It's like there's obviously some kind of change on the horizon here, you know. Like they're obviously having to do something about the situation.
Mm.
So that Egon Kranzbein, the new head of state, said, yes, we're going to open up new border crossings and stuff like this. And I'd been making this album, and I finished making this Division, recording this Division album on the 2nd of November, 1989. And I thought, I'll just take a break, 10 days, 2 weeks, just go on holiday with some friends. And then I'm going to come back, I'll produce the album to the end, you know. At this point, there was no indication of what was going to happen. Yeah? And a week later, on the night of the 8th and 9th of November 1989, I left Berlin with my friends to go to Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, to Nicolae Ceaușescu's Romania. Right? So we're in Krakow on the 9th of November, went to Auschwitz, you know, because I thought pogrom night, it'd probably be some kind of celebration of some kind of, like, you know, memorial service or something. Might be quite interesting to see. Nothing, there was nothing, you know. And we didn't even know that the wall had come down. I only found out, like, about 10 days later.
10 days later?
Wow. That the wall had come down. Yeah. And, like, you know, found a note. I went to the hotel reception and got a newspaper, and it said East German troops tear down wall. And I'm like, what wall? What are they talking about? Is this some kind of like Hungarian private eye? You know, it's like, wow, they've taken away the Berlin Wall. There's a picture of a guy drinking a bottle of champagne on the Berlin Wall. You know, it's like amazing. You know, like, what's going on? And you know, like when we came back, we caught all the other revolutions basically on the way back. You know, Czechoslovakia, we're in there in the middle of Czechoslovakia in Prague, and having their Velvet Revolution. My mates, who at the meantime, you know, one of them was the press spokesman for Charter 77, Václav Havel's Charter 77. You know, when we'd entered Czechoslovakia to go through to go to Hungary and stuff, he'd been in prison for about 6 months with Václav Havel, you know, and suddenly there he is on the balcony waving to the, you know, millions there with Václav Havel and Alexander Dubček and stuff, and I'm like, what's going on? This is the world topsy turvy, you know. And come back to Berlin and it's never, nothing's the same again, you know. Very weird.
That was Mark Reeder chatting with me on May the 1st, 2018, in a real cafe with real people in real seats, without social distancing, without masks, without even the idea that outside dystopian science fiction that could be even a thing. Utterly unaware, blissfully unaware, on a day in Berlin, May the 1st, where street parades, anarchic fun, dancing happens. Thank you so much, Mark, for letting me go back and play you all a much longer version of that. It was so fascinating for me to go back and listen and kind of really get into so much of this amazing story. And if you want to see a visual trip of that, check out the film, if you've not already, B-Movie. It's made up of lots of old footage that Mark took, that people around him took, of Berlin in the 80s mostly. It features Nick Cave, Tilda Swinton, Gudrun Gutt, lots of really incredible creative people, and just lots of insane, creative, anarchic, musical happenings from a time that is so different to now, even though it's really on a larger scale not that long ago. Mark has some music out at the moment. The Subversive Decadent double album features his own tracks and remixes for New Order, Yellow and Liars, amongst others. A collaborative album he did with Alanis Chosnau came out not that long ago. It's awesome. Children of Nature. I'll be back next week. There's also, I think next week, or maybe the week after, but very, very, very soon, there's a Lost and Sound production coming out. Additionally, I sort of teased a little bit about this last week. And that's all I'm going to say for now. I'm going to just tease it again for another week, but I'm very, very excited about that. I hope you're having a really beautiful day, and I really look forward to checking in with you next week. Sound is written and produced by me, Paul Hanford. Title music by ESO. And a big thanks to Kieran Yates in the UK for mastering the levels. This episode is being hosted by Bear Radio, and you can check out other English language podcasts from Berlin by going on bearradio.org. And if you enjoyed listening, please subscribe and leave a comment. It really does help. And you can also help with the production costs of making Lost and Sound by buying me a digital coffee at coffee.com. There's links to everything in the socials. Take care and speak to you soon.